Welcome back, everyone. This is the Clean Call for March 8, 2016. As I guess most of you know, we've been sort of reeling from a bit of this sad news this week about the passing of Gary Brash, who has been a good friend and colleague of ours for many, many years, and we certainly totally appreciated his spirit and his amazing photographs as he's documented climate change. I'm curious if there's anyone else on the line who has, you know, some comments or, you know, thoughts, reflections.
This is Frank. I mean, I only knew Gary a little bit, but his loss is an absolute tragic thing. And I know that, I mean, the comments online, if you haven't been following them, are really worth everyone's time to really reflect on the depth and vision that he had. So, you know, and I think one of the legacies that I think a couple of people talked about is, you know, Gary has, you know, been documenting and then going back and repeating those photographic expeditions around the world over and over again. And that is a torch or a baton that has been laid down. And I think that given, you know, as we move through climate change, and hopefully not as extreme as we had hoped, his work is worth somebody continuing on. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that would work, but it's a very important body of work. He started before almost anybody else, maybe anybody else in the space, and, you know, it needs to be continued. I think that's the best thing Gary would, you know, want besides, you know, progress on climate change.
Great. Thank you so much, Frank.
Sure. My pleasure.
Any other thoughts from anyone? I think the article in the New York Times with Lynn Cherry, who's been a frequent caller and presenter on these calls, her comments were really wonderful, and the whole article, I think, gave us a strong sense of Gary the man and also this amazing piece of work that he dedicated his life to.
I second that, Scott. It's a great piece.
Good. So if there are no other comments at this time, and I'm sure we'll have some other reflections as time goes on, as other details maybe come out or whatever, or you know, forms of tribute, as sort of Frank was suggesting, that's something we can discuss in future calls. So are there any other announcements today?
I have one, Scott.
Yeah, please do. Thanks, Frank.
This is good news.
Good.
So Tamara Ledley, who we all know and love, who is still in the South Pacific enjoying, I believe, an eclipse with her husband.
Isn't it today? Isn't it scheduled for today? Or, well, it could have been yesterday.
Exactly. Very soon. But she started a process with the ESIP Federation to begin to plan for, Scott, your retirement.
Thank you.
your contributions over the years have been most appreciated, but as we've said in previous calls, we do need to let you go and enjoy your retirement. So to try and help keep momentum going in the clean community, we have reached out and secured a ESIF Education Fellow and somebody who we worked with for the Youth for Climate Initiatives in Paris. Johanna from the Earth Day Network has gone back to school, and thereby she's a student again, and she has agreed to be a ESIP Climate Education Fellow, and part of her agreement is to pick up some of the work that you've done, Scott, so that's come to pass.
It very
is
good.
Successful. Yeah, we have success. So we're working out the details, but it seems like it's going to all work out beautifully. So, Scott, Thank you, and know that your work will continue.
Great. I'll go work on my book. It's almost all of us do. It's great. My understanding is there will probably be a little change in how we do these calls in the future. We'll be using probably some of the technology, at least this was my understanding, is the same technology that we use in the COP21 calls from Paris. And I think we all agreed that the sound and we had video too, so it's all of that stuff is really very, very helpful. So we'll probably see that change happen soon. Very
yep.
good. I can just mention that next week is going to be actually our first informal discussion in actually several weeks. We've had a number of presentations in the last couple of weeks. But next week we have a little bit of breather, and hopefully we can have a discussion about some of the things that we've learned in quite a variety of talks in the last couple of weeks. And after that, Gail Francis and Amy Curtis from the Garfield Foundation are going to talk about the REAMP network. And that will be, in some ways, echoes the conversation we had around solution-based. This is a much, definitely dealing with a very practical look at climate change. I think in the Midwest, if I remember correctly, where REAMP is. And that presentation will be on the 22nd of March. And while I'm at it, I am Emily Schoeninger from National Center for Science Education is going to talk about their Science Booster Club project, and that's on the 29th of March. So there's the next couple of weeks of calls coming up. So I hope you can join us, of course. Any other announcements that prompted? So here in that, as you know, we have a presentation today from Paul Fleshman, who's going to talk about, I guess it's sort of the development and probably the response to a book that he wrote recently called Eyes Open Wide, Going Behind the Environmental Headlines. Paul has written all kinds of things, many of them for children and young adults, and I'm very eager to hear his work on all of this stuff. So, Paul, please go ahead. I can just mention to people that his slides are, of course, available on our webpage. I hope you've had a chance to download those. So welcome, Paul. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Yes, the slides might mystify you as well. You might want to listen in to figure out what the heck I've got them doing up there. So I have been a writer of fiction for many decades, mainly, poetry, short stories, novels, plays, you name it. But a few years ago, I began noticing dead bees accumulating on my driveway in tiny Aromas, California, about 10 miles inland from the coast and 100 miles south of the Bay Area. And slide number two is me holding said bee. And more and more began to accumulate. And then I noticed something else. I hadn't seen a swallow for years. And there used to be swallows over our field regularly. I hadn't seen a bat at night or heard a bat at night for years. Spring in that town was announced in part by the appearance of dead snakes run over in the road. Hadn't seen a snake in years. And suddenly there was this sense that there was a Holocaust going on that was out of sight, out of hearing, and out of the news. And I decided to switch gears and move into nonfiction. I'd done just a very little bit before, but nothing as ambitious as covering a broad, breaking story like the environment. And I came to the conclusion that we're essentially, in the U.S., kind of like in 1941. The war has been going on in Asia for years, in Europe for a couple of years, but here the World Series is still happening and everything's hunky-dory. We haven't had Pearl Harbor yet. And that's the challenge of somebody explaining the environment, is to make it as real as after Pearl Harbor, even though we haven't had Pearl Harbor, and we probably won't have anything quite like that, or like the Lusitania. In both cases, suddenly we woke up, and overnight we were committed to World War I and World War II. That's not going to happen here. So how can we make the same reaction take place? I decided to aim my book toward young adults, and I use that term broadly. So I'm thinking of everybody from middle school students up through college. And frankly, after I wrote the book, I discovered that adults were as in the dark about the environmental facts of life, the same way teens were. I got questions from adults, you know, we have recycling barrels, where's the problem? Like we've got it covered. I've had an adult ask me whether or not water was a fossil fuel. I know that adult. She's quite well educated and quite well traveled. That showed me how far off in the wings, how far from center stage the environment is for many people. And so to do this book, I had to unlearn the arts of imagining, of inventing, that I usually use, and learn the art of explaining. And to do that, I actually went back to my best teachers and asked myself what it was they did. And here's the conclusion I came to. They were people who didn't just give you facts. They gave you context. They gave you something larger in which to put the fact. And that made all the difference. Maybe they gave you history. Maybe they showed you that the Beatles in slide number 3 were actually the great-great-great-great-grandchild of string quartets in slide number 4. They gave you principles. So if you learned that the central government was weak in the time of King John in slide 5 and you get Magna Carta, well, that's a great principle to know. You'll then understand why in the Congo, where there's a very weak central government, you have warlords. You learn the names for things, and that is so powerful, such a great way to really etch that principle into your mind. So slide 7 is a picture of soldiers training. I think in World War I, they're practicing with their bayonets on straw man, straw men. And that's the name, of course, given to the straw man fallacy. And how does that fallacy work? You take your opponent's argument, you change it from a potent force into just a straw man, you distort it, and then you demolish it. So when Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma produces a snowball in the halls of the Senate, he's a classic example of the straw man fallacy. He's reduced the argument to being global warming means there's no more snow. And then he demolishes that by producing a snowball. You learn a term like totem animal. And slide 9 is a buffalo dance from one of the Plains Indian tribes. And once you know there's such a thing as a totem animal from which the tribe believes it derives its identity, you begin noticing totem animals everywhere, the bald eagle in number 10, the California state flag in number 11, every college team in number 12, represented by the Badgers of Wisconsin, and my own favorite totem animal, a totem gastropod from UC Santa Cruz near me, the banana slug. I think people who were very bad in their past life come back and find themselves on the track team of the UC Santa Cruz, a squad. How'd you like to be the slugs? Lastly, I went back to a teacher I had in 12th grade who had us read Man and His Symbols by Carl Jung. And Jung had a dream. And in the dream, he took his thoughts to the public, to the lay public. And he took his dream seriously. And he gathered some of his disciples, and they each wrote chapters in this book. And the great thing about it was it had documentary things inside. It had still photos from films. It had headlines. It had news photos, all kinds of stuff. And for the first time, it seemed, in my education, I saw that the things we were learning in school were actually tied to real life, the life around me. That was powerful. That never left me. I still have that beat-up paperback of Man and His Symbols. And so off I went. I found a lot of other good books along the way. I learned a lot along the way, and that's what I really want to share with you mainly here. the first thing I learned is that kids don't know the facts of life, and as I mentioned, neither do adults. So when I go into a classroom and I ask, for instance, you know, where does the electricity in this room come from when I flip the switch? How is it made? I know what will happen. I will see a few waving hands of kids making wild guesses, and in the back, I will see teachers frantically on their phones. They also don't know. They will be trying to beat me to the crossing or their students and come up with the answer because they have no idea of where the electricity comes from or the water or where the garbage goes, et cetera, et cetera. So early on in the book, actually, I presented some of it to a very good school. This was an eighth grade class at a charter school. And I asked for a show of hands on how many students had seen An Inconvenient Truth. And I assumed every hand would go up. Only one hand went up, and it was not the teacher's. I had assumed that movie was, you know, standard operating procedure in schools for bringing kids up to date. Not so. So I really had to go back, rethink the book in a lot of ways. It's one reason it took me several years to write. I was continually doing that. So my advice to teachers, start as if kids don't know anything, because we're actually all in that situation. I was in that situation when I started the book. I didn't know how my electricity was made. I didn't know just where my watershed was, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole chapter in the book on out of sight, called Out of Sight, and the out of sight phenomenon is one of the big hurdles we have with the environment. So much is out of sight. Next thing, fear. So slide 15 shows the cover of a really pretty wonderful book by Stuart Brand called Whole Earth Discipline. And inside of it is this quote, and you've undoubtedly heard or read many such quotes like this. He pulled it from another book on the environment. It goes like this. Forests are being cut down, wetlands drained, coral reefs grubbed up, agricultural lands eroded, salinized, desertified, or simply paved over. Pollution is now generalized. Our groundwater, streams, rivers, estuaries, seas and oceans, the air we breathe, the food we eat, all are affected. If current trends persist, in no more than a few decades, it will cease to be capable of supporting complex forms of life. And here is Stuart Brand's take on that paragraph. The author's worries are accurate individually, but they are selective, one-sided, and over-aggregated into a paralyzing spasm of angst. Indeed, a little fear is a good thing. You're floating merrily down the stream in your canoe. Suddenly you hear the sound of a falls ahead. You wake up, you sit up, and you paddle toward the shore. Too much fear? Paralyzing. This is something that is a real problem with the environment and a real problem for young people because they have those who have been exposed to environmental issues often are left with a sense of absolute powerlessness. And when you're paralyzed and powerless, you're not going to do anything to improve the situation. It's crucial, I learned, to describe problems, yes, but with solutions. Problems without solutions just lead to depression. Okay, what have we got next? So next I've got on slide 17, Al Gore at the beginning of his piece in The Turning Point, an article in Rolling Stone. I just realized, yes, that's up on the slide. You can read it. I don't need to read these things to you, but I will anyway. The forward journey for human civilization will be difficult and dangerous, but it's now clear that we will ultimately prevail. The only question is how quickly we can accelerate and complete the transition to a low-carbon civilization. This takes the opposite tack from that previous quote. Gore declares victory in paragraph one, and that gives you so much confidence and so much energy and so much hope that it gets you through paragraph 2 through 39, which describes significant obstacles ahead. But that's the way hope works. It energizes. Martin Luther King didn't say, I've got a nightmare we need to avoid. He said, I have a dream. Dreams pull us forward. They energize. Something we need to remember as teachers, as speakers, as whenever we're talking to people about this problem. Next point, the power of the big picture. So slide 19 is taken from the website I created for the book, eyeswideopenupdates.com, and this is one of the blog posts in it, with that very powerful photo of Too Big to Fail, that banner. The great thing about the big picture is it really changes how you see all the small pictures. It gives you clarity. It gives you a powerful viewing point. You know, is Keystone, would the Keystone pipeline have been good for jobs? Is fracking bad for water? Doesn't matter. All that matters is keeping those fossil fuels in the ground. Once you have that perspective, it makes other things very clear. I'll put an aside in here about the website. Nonfiction authors, until quite recently, had a huge disadvantage. The moment they finished their books, they were out of date. The website has solved that. So I've got a tab for headlines. You can see this morning's environmental news on there. I can put in blog posts on topics that I didn't have room for in the book. I can post corrections. I can update the list of recommended resources, which I do frequently. It's been a fabulous resource for authors. The downside is you could spend the rest of your life writing your book. Yes, you could write just one book, especially on a topic so broad. So it is kind of a time sink, and I've had to cut back a bit. But it's also been exciting. I took a class in video production last summer, and I made two videos, which are up on the blog, one on the California drought and one on the interesting parallels between football and fossil fuels and their history. So, onward. Crucial when you're talking about the environment with, again, any age, is showing action that we can do. So I've posted a few things here. Slide 20 is the website for Zooniverse. They are a clearinghouse for citizen science projects, the kind you can do in your pajamas in bed with your laptop. You get a tutorial, and off you go, looking at slides, identifying cancer cells, or counting penguins, or looking for a certain type of galaxy. Pooling together people's time in citizen science projects has been incredible. It has brought in all kinds of data that wasn't there before. So there is eBird, which instead of just doing a Christmas count with the Audubon Club, you can post your bird sightings every day of the year. So huge torrents of data have come in. I'm involved in one that takes you out in the field. It's called Beachcombers. And in it, pairs of people comb certain beach, a particular beach once a month, and they write down every dead bird or sea mammal, log them all, take measurements, et cetera, et cetera. Why do we do this? Turns out that we know less about the oceans than we do about Mars. And this is one little keyhole into what's going on out there. So we have had some very large mortality events, and this is one way we find out about them. The power of pooling is very, very strong. I think I'll talk about it later. I can't remember. I haven't seen my notes. Haven't gone that far. So other kinds of actions. Good to know. Look at number 21. You see that and you realize how different life could be. That looks like an artist's rendition. It's in Holland. It's called the Hovenring, and it's a way to separate bicycle traffic from car traffic. God, do I wish we had that here in Santa Cruz, and probably everywhere all of you are as well.
That's so cool.
Yeah, if only. Let's see. One of the big raps on solar power is, well, where are we going to get all the land for all the square miles of collectors we need? people have come up with all kinds of different ways to do it. This one is on a number 22 on a pedestrian or a bikeway. They've put collectors over canals. There is experimentation going on with solar roads. Can you imagine how many square miles of asphalt we've got sitting out there? And the great advantage there is that the solar collectors in there could melt snow and ice, so you wouldn't be there. You could have messages flashed. It would also power electric cars. That would be fabulous. Number 23 is probably my favorite of all in this sphere. It was a project done by a Arizona State student, heavily influenced by origami, and the assignment was to come up with a toothpaste tube that would actually get all the toothpaste out when you were done. But just looking at it, that tells kids and adults the world could be very different. There's more than one way to skin a cat. Mm-hmm. And this kind of thing is really helpful when somebody tells you, well, we can't possibly get fossil fuels all out of our life. They're in everywhere. It's too big. And the answer to them is this toothpaste tube. We can actually do all kinds of things. And in fact, fossil fuels, until very recently, weren't woven into our lives. They had to be put there. And they were put there with the same ingenuity that we're now applying to getting them out, the kind of ingenuity that gives us a toothpaste tube that looks like that. So, action, very important. Also important to give some historical perspective with that. 24 is the cover of a book, The Death and Life of Monterey Bay. Things don't only get worse. The environmental news doesn't always look that way. And it's important to know that humans can make news be better. I actually lived through that. I grew up in L.A., and when I was young, you could never see Catalina Island 20 miles offshore. It was the rare day when a rainstorm would wash the air, and there it was. Oh, my God, look at that thing. Who knew? These days, completely the opposite. You routinely see Catalina, and it's the rare day in which you don't. We did a lot of things. We passed the Clean Air Act. We got unleaded gasoline. We did all kinds of stuff. When I was a kid, we had smog alerts. You weren't allowed to go play outside. And I can well remember, you would take a breath in, inhale, and you would have to cough. Not true anymore. Thank goodness. So onward. Onward to the topic of wonder. This is crucial. Emerson has a quote. It says, "Do not waste yourself in rejection, nor bark against the bad, but chant the beauty of the good." That is a great way to go. People have often said that people won't save the environment unless they first learn to love it. Quite true. How do you learn to love it? By experiencing it, by experiencing wonder. There are a lot of different routes to that. It could be hiking and backpacking. It could be looking through a microscope. It could be watching the incredible reboot of the Cosmos TV series in 25 with Neil deGrasse Tyson in place of Carl Sagan. If you haven't seen it, you've got a treat ahead. It's about 9 or 10 episodes, and they not only leave you with wonder about the universe, but about how we got to figure out how it works in part and are continuing to. That is an incredible story, incredibly impressive. At the same time that Cosmos was on TV was another wonderful show called Your Inner Fish. If you haven't seen that, check it out. It's based on a book by Neil Shubin, S-H-U-B-I-N. Your Inner Fish. So he basically looks at evolution through our own bodies. And, you know, our bodies are a museum, really, of evolution. And he walks you through it. Very entertaining. Very eye-opening. I recommend it highly. One of the big problems you face explaining the environment to young people or any people is, you know, what can we do? There is that sense. I was at the People's Climate March in New York City in 2014. That's a shot of it in slide 27. Oh, yeah, I skipped ahead a bit, but I'm going to. And, you know, they expected 100,000 people, and they got 400,000. There is such a will to do something. And at this point, most people feel that the most they can do is register their desire for a change, march in the streets. So there is a huge, huge will. The question is, you know, where's the lever? Where can people, they want to pull that lever to make change. Where is it? Where is it? Well, it's kind of hiding in plain sight, in my view. I talked about citizen science and pooling together expertise. Pooling has been used in a lot of places. Let's think about Wikipedia, pooled expertise there. Citizen science is mainly pooled time. Kickstarter, pooled spare change. The biggest pooling thing I see waiting to happen is votes. Talk about potential energy, as in chemistry. You know, in the last general election, 2014, like 35% of voters voted. There is a lot of waiting to be pooled out there, especially among young people. So slide 26 is me registering some of those banana slug people at UCSC. We would not have the same Congress we have if 100% of people were voting. That is for sure. So don't neglect the power of pooling. And in fact, when people, you know, walk to work or bike to work or grow a little vegetable patch or do something else small, they tend to think they're kind of wasting their time, that it's kind of hopeless. But I don't think so at all. Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times had a great line some time ago. I think it was actually in his book on making the world a better place. And the line was, a drop in the bucket, that's how buckets get filled. If we lived in a perfect world and our government were requiring us to ride bikes or making it much easier than it is, and the tables were turned and it was much easier to ride a bike than to drive a car and to grow your own food than to buy it at Safeway, et cetera, wouldn't that be wonderful? We'd all be doing that. Well, some of us are doing that now. We're not waiting for that to come down from above. We're not waiting for, you know, the rationing that happened in World War II. We're just doing it. And when you do it, you're having the same effect whether or not everybody's doing it or not. Big movements are made from moving that decimal point. So, yes, it's important that much larger numbers do it, but what can we do in our own lives? We can bike or we can drive. We have a choice every day. Making that choice to bike is an important choice. Getting that decimal point moved, well, that takes political action. And I think we need to be encouraging that in our young people. I've been speaking lately about Eyes Wide Open at college campuses, and teachers are very worried about their students. They feel they're very checked out from the political process. If Trump is the candidate, will that bring them out? Who knows? Who knows? But I certainly think it's worth encouraging. It's crucial. Absolutely. Lastly, the poster I designed for the book, the last slide of an eye chart. It all starts with noticing and the ability to read that world around us, to look behind what we normally just walk by or sleepwalk through, to look down from above and see that big picture. That's what I tried to encourage in the book. The book is short. It's really about 150 pages of text with back matter. It has a lot on non-scientific things because I do think that money is as big a factor here as molecules are. There's a whole section on how to weigh information, which is crucial. There's quite a bit in the book, but the chapters are brief, and they each tackle a different topic, a different kind of reason or a place, how we got here or why we're stuck. So there's geography, there's psychology, there are defense mechanisms, there's capitalism, there's democracy. It'll certainly be the first time some junior high or high school students have encountered the idea that there might be something wrong with capitalism or that democracy might have flaws, something good for them to know and to muse on. In some ways, the book is a better fit for college because you don't have the problem with those topics. Socrates was given hemlock for corrupting youth, and I was disinvited from a whole school district where I was going to go after an administrator read the book. So colleges are a great place as well. Indeed, at UCSC, close to me, to get in to the UCs, you need to have a very high grade point average and very good test scores. But the students who are coming in, according to the teachers, yeah, they do great on those things, but they haven't connected their knowledge to the real world. And they're sadly uninformed on what's actually going on around them, which is why Eyes Wide Open is being used at more and more colleges, especially with incoming students, giving them that foundation of knowledge. Most people are not going to read Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. It's fabulous. It's potent, powerful writing, but it's 480 pages. Only true believers are going to probably pick it up. Eyes Wide Open is much more accessible. Obviously, it's a different kind of book with a different audience. So that's my take. I'm now open for questions.
Hi, I came in late, and I don't know if I'm on the right phone call. What's the title of your book?
What is the what of the book?
What's the title of your book? Because I'm not sure I'm on the right phone call.
Okay. The title of the book is Eyes Wide Open. The subtitle is Going Behind the Environmental Headlines. My name is Paul Fleischman.
Oh, sure. Yeah, hi. This is Lynn Sherry, and I'm the co-author with Gary Brosh of How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate, how a scientist and kids explore global warming. And we also co-produced a film series called Young Voices for the Planet. And you were talking about how do you get this army of people to vote and to go out and speak out. And that was our objective, and I don't know if you're aware, but Gary died yesterday on the Great Barrier Reef. I don't know if anyone knows Gary Brosh, but he was a very famous photojournalist who spent his whole life photographing climate change, and it's a very tragedy. But there was a study that shows that most people get their environmental information from the materials that they bring home from school, and that there's an ELF, a League of Conservation Voters study, and it shows that most people are, that the biggest influence on them is their children. And so we felt that by reaching children and having the parents, having them basically teach their parents well, that
exactly.
We could get enough adults. And so the films have been very effective, and they are in April they're going on. They were licensed by American Public Television, and they'll be on 55 public broadcasting stations and reach 11 million people. And so we also have PBS Learning Media, which is the curriculum that goes with those films that's used by 1.8 million teachers, one-third of all the schools in the country. The reason I'm mentioning this is because we have this opportunity through this platform to get the scientific information that probably many of the people on this call have created, projects they're working on. We're going to promote the Citizens Climate Lobby, that is trying to get a price on carbon through a fee and dividend. And so hopefully if we can mobilize these young people to talk to their parents about something very, one very specific action, like, talking to their congresspeople about signing the Gibson, the Gibson Amendment, or talking to their elected officials about a fee and dividend, that maybe that's the way we can get some action.
Uh-huh. Well, bravo. Bravo. Yes, Gary Sess was announced at the opening of the call.
Mm-hmm.
You bring up a good point, and adults aren't going to school anymore, but kids are, and so, you know, if they have good information, that's really important. Where are adults getting their information? God only knows. You know, it could be they're getting no information if they're watching primetime TV. It could be Fox News, you know, obviously, a lot of different sources. So teaching our children well is really, really key. Absolutely. It's one reason I think young adults are just the best possible audience for this. They're old enough to spend their money wisely or think about where it's going. They're idealistic. They don't have those careers and mortgages. They're old enough to vote in many, many cases, or old enough almost to vote, but they're young enough to be flexible. Their opinions aren't set in concrete yet. They're open still. So to me, they're crucial. And of course, they're the ones who are going to be running things in that far-off country, it used to seem far-off, of mid-century.
So this is Frank and Noah. Thank you very much for all your work. And Lynn, you know, we spent some time reflecting on Gary's life at the beginning of this, so thank you for joining us. But, you know, I think the focus on youth in this space is a critical one that I think our community is well-positioned to share a better reason for engaging them in this space. There's a lot of reasons why, but I think one of the things, as we've had conversations with philanthropic organizations around the world, to see, you know, where the funding is going to come for the climate and energy education engagement community, and it's really not there. It's very anemic. It's not sufficient to the opportunity, and it's not sufficient to the need. But I think one of the big barriers that we have before us is that the people who are concerned about these issues, which are very present, very large, and require action now, they see this tough we're talking about as not worthy of the money. They would rather do direct lobbying to legislators. They forget the youth part. They forget the education part. And I think that it's up to us together to come up with a much more compelling reason for doing exactly what Lynn and others on the call have already said. But I think we're each of us are making these cases by ourselves, and I don't think we've done the due diligence to make the compelling nature of the case as effectively as we can. So I think we need to do a better job of doing that. I think we're getting there, but I don't think we're there now, because if you talk to a lot of them, they see other priorities, and they don't see us as a priority yet. And
yeah,
Let's just remember, 1 in 4 people in the United States is a student. 1 in 4. That's a huge fraction.
Yeah.
And a lot of major initiatives happen with less of a fraction than that. So it's a powerful space. Yeah,
Frank? This is Martha. What did you say, 1 in every 4 people?
Is a student.
Oh, okay.
There's 76 million students, 20 million at the higher education, and 54 million are in K-12.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that number keeps on changing. 1 in 4, it's about 23.7%, something in that order. But, you know, it's roughly 1 in 4. That's, it takes what you're talking about and really ramps it up majorly. But in order for us to get there, we're going to need some help. And that help requires resources.
Yeah, I hear you.
Gary. Oh, sorry. Show where my mind is. Paul, I'm curious what the reception has been of the book itself, how people are actually using it. As you said, you primarily wrote it, I guess, for the K-12 sort of young adult, but you're finding that it's getting used in probably undergrad classes. I'm kind of curious how people are using the book as a reference material or in a more active way.
Well, interestingly, my publisher thought that the way to promote the book was not so much the environment, but as a book excellent for teaching critical thinking.
Okay.
And those people turned out to be right. So that's one way it's being used. It was adopted into the Tampa schools curriculum, one of the largest school districts in the country. But that was the way it got in, as a way to teach critical thinking, because it looks at multiple sides of issues, raises a lot of contemporary issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that was done in high schools, or middle schools and high schools. How exactly it's being used, the author is usually the last to know. Sometimes, you know, I find out in different ways, talking to teachers, but often I don't find things out till years later, or people just never post them, what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to kind of guess or talk to the people I know who are using the book. It has short chapters, so it's pretty easy to excerpt it. I think it will start appearing in textbooks that are geared toward critical thinking. They'll probably, I'm waiting for those to start coming in. The book only came out a year and a half ago, so it hasn't had time to work its way into things. Teachers and administrators and curriculum people don't necessarily read Publishers Weekly and The Horn Book, et cetera, et cetera. And teachers certainly don't have time. So it takes a while for a book to work its way in. So I'm not getting that much information right now. I think I'll know a lot more in another few years.
Paul, you mentioned earlier that you were disinvited from speaking in one school district. Has there been a similar kind of response to the book? Are people coming back? And is an issue that we are often talk about on this call, the pushback because of the topic area. I'm curious whether you're also seeing that, or maybe it's, as you say, it's too early to tell.
Yeah, it's. I haven't encountered any other examples like that, and I think that was probably a first for a Newbery medalist to be have to stay home. But I'm honored. That means I did my job. I wrote a good book then. My father would be very proud of me. So I'm not aware of others. I'm sure that has been repeated other places. And probably for those chapters I mentioned, democracy and capitalism.
This is a more controversial.
Hi, this is Julie Lambert, and I'm a professor at Florida Atlantic University and University of Miami, and I'm teaching about 100 pre-service teachers every year. And at University of Miami, I'm teaching a class on climate and society, and I just ordered your book, and I might think about incorporating it in my classes with teachers, and I think that would be a great way to actually get it out into the schools. And also, I'm going to Costa Rica to do a teacher workshop, and I was wondering if you have any Spanish resources or something I can share with teachers who are not necessarily bilingual.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and I wish I had a happy answer for you. The sad fact is that the book has so much art in the margins, so many photos, just like I was describing in Carl Jung's Man and His Symbols, that the permissions issue has been daunting. And we did have a publisher who wanted to publish it in Spanish, and the people I worked with getting all the rights to all of that have balked at pursuing it, opening that up all over again for foreign editions. And so we're still waiting to hear if that might be possible. So currently there's no Spanish edition, alas. Going through teachers is a great way. I was just speaking earlier, when was that? Just a few days ago in Bloomington, to prospective teachers. It is a great way to go, even if they're going to be teaching maybe a slightly different subject. But let's face it, these environmental facts of life are just as important as the biological ones. And more, they're going to come to the fore. These are going to be the facts of life that everybody needs. And they won't be out of sight so much. So I think you're at a good point. You're on a leading edge. And I salute you.
Thank you. Owl, is your email address somewhere in your PowerPoint? I didn't see it.
It is
not. Information.
I didn't even think of that. So let me give it to you now. So my email address is the letter P, like Paul. The letter T. And then, so we've got P like Paul. We've got T like Thomas. And then we've got Fleischman. Fleischman at Gmail. So PT Fleischman at Gmail.
Okay.
Back to the response to the book, it was quite well reviewed. It got dynamite reviews. It got starred reviews everywhere except Hornbook. It was skipped for the major awards given by the American Library Association. That was a disappointment. But it's probably just seen as a little too much advocacy rather than straight nonfiction.
Okay.
Even though the book does not give a list of 50 things that kids can do to save the Earth. There's nothing like that in there. It's all to give readers a foundation. And then they can go off and do what they want with it. But it's just foundation. It really doesn't press action. But it did. It was a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize. It won some environmental awards. Yeah. It's a tough topic. People really don't want to engage with the environment. It's like taking a really hard required class in college, you know, organic chemistry, instead of taking badminton, a nice elective.
That would be a really cool short film.
What would be?
Just parts of the book, almost like a very fast. I don't know, just turning into a short film with the images and some dialogue. I'll bet you could get in some film festivals.
Uh-huh.
But the topic is such a good topic.
Yeah. Well, video is a great way to go. That's why I decided to make two, to try to reach younger people who really prefer that. So check out the ones on the blog site, eyeswideopenupdates.com.
Oh, okay.
The football one and the drought.
Paul, this is Frank Nipold again. Are you aware of the University of California's bending the curve, 10 scalable solutions for carbon neutrality and stability?
I am not.
Have you heard about that?
Bending
the curve. It's an initiative that the entire university system is doing. And these 10 solutions... But if I remember right, one of the solutions is education focused. You can't do this without education. And I'm trying to remember which one it is. I'll find it. But you know, a lot of times everything you said about, you know, depression and overwhelmingness and connecting solutions in real ways are all totally right. But I think one of the things that that the university system is doing, I saw a presentation this not too long ago, and they're really figuring out how the University System of California, which is a really large enterprise and has a lot of influence, could be used. And Janet Napolitano is the head now. So I think there might be something there to explore with what you're doing, and they might find easy entry points for use of your resource.
Mm-hmm. I will check it out. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
This is Lynn Cherry again, and I was thinking that the book would, what we could do is take some of the ideas about critical thinking to and put them as part of this curriculum that we're developing for PBS Learning Media, and it to be sort of like the hook, and then have the link to the book if people wanted to, you know, dive deeper and have it be part, you know, really get into their curriculum. So if you're interested, I can send you an email and just see if you're interested in working that up with me. And you know, for anyone else on the call, I feel like we have this great opportunity where we have this huge platform that's going to reach these millions of teachers, and that they do go to this platform. So as far as actually getting it to them, they'll come to it, and we just have to deliver them the content that's really exciting to them. And this sounds like it really is exciting. And it would all be tied to the standards, things that they have to teach anyway, but sort of a more interesting way of teaching it.
Sounds good. Send me an email.
Okay.
And, Paul, I found the solution. It's solution two. So in the bending the curve framework, it's the second one, which is foster
okay.
a global culture of climate action through coordinated public communication and education at local to global scales. So, and there's a lot more detail beyond that.
Great, thank you.
So hopefully that helps you.
Yeah.
And same
you.
With you, Lynn, and everyone else, for that matter.
That's great to know. Any more questions for Paul or Lynn in this case, too? I'm so glad you were able to join us today.
Given maybe there's no other question, Lynn, do you know if there's any consideration for how to remember Gary, any funds, or what we can do to share our thoughts and reflections on his life?
I'm so glad that you asked, because that's really been what a lot of people have been discussing. I've got hundreds of calls and emails yesterday and today, and I've been talking to the Society of Environmental Journalists, and they have a prize for photographers or for photojournalists, and we were talking about naming this prize after Gary, and so I guess the question is then, you know, raising funds to, you know, I was going to offer to donate something, but I think, you know, it could really be quite a big prize if everyone who loved him and used his photographs and respected him so much would, you know, contribute to this fund. And then the idea being, you know, he's got really big shoes to fill, and to try and locate photographers, you know, coming up who will follow in his footsteps and take up his work and continue to document the effects of climate change on the world, but also the solutions, because, you know, the solutions was a really big part of his work as well. So as that firms up, I'll make sure I keep in touch with everyone and let you know what's going on. Do you
have you heard
of anything else besides Society of Environmental Journalists?
No, I just thought. I mean, there's many ideas that we could do, but
what about ILCC? What is ILCC?
Legal Conservation Photographers.
Oh, okay. I know Gary was a founding member of the Society of Environmental Journalists, so I know that's where his heart was, and he'd go to those meetings every year, and they really loved him and honored him. I don't know how deeply involved he was with the other group, but I can probably find out. So, that would be a good idea to follow up with any leads that you have. You know, any ideas you have would be really appreciated.
Thank you, Lynn.
Yes, thank you, everyone. And thank you, Paul. I think you can get a sense of how, you know, the work you're doing and the work that Gary did, how it all relates. It really shows the extraordinary power that artists have to play in this really challenge, this huge challenge. So thank you so much for your contribution today, and thank you to everyone.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Scott.
Bravo. stay in touch.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.